We're talking about toxic lead exposure in children here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Children are especially at risk from lead because of their small size and their developing brains. According to the CDC, lead exposure can affect every system in the body, and even low levels in the blood have been shown to affect a child's IQ. Have you or someone you know been affected by lead pipes in your home? What did you do? In Milwaukee, were you promised lead testing or water filters? Did the city follow up with you if your infant or toddler tested positive for lead? What was the result? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Dipesh Navsaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He is president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Navsaria, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
What have you learned about how lead affects the body?
So we've known a lot about lead in the field of pediatrics for quite some time. Lead was considered to be very useful in really a large variety of ways in our society for actually thousands of years. But then there was a recognition that lead actually had very insidious effects on children in particular because of how it affected their brain development. And that really led to a series of progressive public health measures over time, starting in the 1970s, really, to remove lead from sources. And what we saw was that blood lead levels in children dropped over time and to much lower levels. However, the key thing that everyone needs to know is that there is no such thing as a safe level of lead. So saying that we're that much better is actually not a good thing. It still does affect kids' brains, and it has a permanent effect. So this isn't something that just goes away when you get rid of the lead. The IQ points are already lost. So this is a massive public health issue, and it's an issue for our society in general.
So lead is a neurotoxin. How does it get into the body?
Yeah, there's a number of ways that lead can get into the body. One of the routes that was fairly common was actually breathing it in, because, of course, we used to have leaded gasoline. I still remember from my childhood when you'd pull into a gas station and they'd ask you, you know, leaded or unleaded. My own kids look at me blankly when I mention that. They're like, what? What is that? So that was one route. The other was that there was lead in paint, in household paint. And you might think, well, how is paint going to matter? Well, young children, toddlers with very quickly developing brains, they'll paint chips and dust, and they'll put their hands in their mouth, and they'll ingest lead in that way. And sometimes we used to find years ago, and still occasionally do in children who may live in much older homes, cases of lead toxicity where they'd actually see lead chips on x-ray because they'd been swallowing them. So that was the main ways. And then as we eliminated those, we have discovered that there are still other sources of lead out there. For example, in old water pipes, which is the issue at hand here. And we still occasionally run into lead in, you know, toys and products that are made to less exacting standards, often in other countries, and imported that haven't been tested. Occasionally, types of makeup or foods is contamination. But those are kind of intermittent and fewer and far between.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Dipesh Navsaria, who is president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, a pediatrician with American Family Children's Hospital. We're talking about the effects of lead exposure in children, taking your questions about lead as well and what it can do to the human body at 800-642-1234. Dr. Navsaria, how do you recognize, are there any symptoms of lead exposure?
Here's the thing that really makes this so insidious is that you need to have fairly high levels of lead exposure for there to be symptoms that anyone can pick up, even an experienced physician. And that's why we actually do so much screening for it. At checkups, we will often ask a series of questions looking for sources of lead exposure, like the age of the home that children may live in, hobbies that the family might have. You know, solder often has lead if they do electronics or something like that. And all, and then if the answer is yes to any of that, we will check, do a quick blood test to see what the lead level is. If it's above a certain level, then we will talk to public health, and they can have someone come and investigate and try to identify the source and make sure that we are eliminating that source wherever possible.
I'm really familiar with those questionnaires with my own children at the pediatrician's office, such as, was your home built before the 1950s? Do you know if there's lead paint in your home? Those are questions, though, that the parent may not really know the answer to. They may know the age of the home, but not whether there is exposure to lead in the home. Should those questions be the only factor when considering whether you should test a newborn or test an infant?
Yeah, and usually, by the way, as a toddler, we would test because they're the ones that are putting their hands in their mouth and so on. A newborn, we shouldn't see high lead levels unless there's the mother was exposed as well, and that would be another issue. Yeah, I think it's a great question, and what I would say is if there's any doubt in your mind, or if you're working with a population that lives in a community that has older housing stock, or there may not have been as much attention paid to pipe replacement or, you know, paint or other abatement type issues, then just test. I mean, actually, in many settings, it doesn't have to be a blood draw from the arm with a needle. We can actually do a little finger poke and at least do an initial test that way. Now, if that test comes back high, it's entirely possible that even if you clean the finger really well, there was a little skin contamination there and not truly blood having lead in it. So then we'll do the blood draw at that point. But if you're, it's fairly easy and inexpensive to do. So if any doubt, we say just test and make sure.
Let's bring in a call now. Joe is joining us from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
So I'm a landlord, and I had an experience with a child that was one of my tenant's children. He had an elevated blood level, and this was in Minnesota, actually. So the Department of Health, after the second health test came back, they had to intervene and, you know, get me on the path to getting it all corrected. So in retrospect, there's a couple of notes that I'd say for any landlords out there or anybody that lives in an older home, if there's any paint that's loose around windows, door jams, stuff like that, stuff you need to, a little maintenance can go a long way on keeping that stuff sealed up. And then also, what I never knew before this was that actually varnishes and stains can have lead in them as well.
Joe, thank you for that. Dr. Navsaria, it's not just the paint, the varnishes. And Joe says, you know, maintenance can go a long way.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because I think sometimes people worry. They say, oh, my goodness, my home was built in 1900 and there's almost definitely lead paint in my home. Do I need to have the whole place stripped down and removed and all? The lead is an issue if the paint is chipping off, or if there's dust getting out towards where children can breathe it in, put their hands in their mouth, all of that. If it's well maintained, if there's new coats of lead free paint, you know, sealing it in, that's actually less of an issue. I will add, for the do it yourself professionals out there, if you know there's lead paint. Please make sure that you're getting it done by a professional.
Talking about the consequences of toxic lead exposure in children with pediatrician Dipesh Navsaria as our guide. Children under 5 are most vulnerable to lead poisoning. What do you want to know about how lead exposure affects children? Are you worried about lead paint or pipes in your home? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Navsaria here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about lead poisoning in children here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So lead was widely used in water pipes until the 50s. Cheap, easy to weld lead soldering used to connect copper piping was used until the 80s, but it can flake into drinking water, damaging a child's growth and ability to learn. Wisconsin blood lead testing data showed nearly 4,000 children across the state were lead poisoned among kids under five who were tested in 2018. And there are parts of the state like Milwaukee where lead poisoning is more prevalent. If you live in Milwaukee, has your baby or toddler had multiple blood lead tests? What do you want to know about the test results and monitoring? What can you tell us about intervention and prevention efforts in your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have pediatrician Dipesh Navsaria who stays with us. Dr. Navsaria, how do pediatricians bring down toxic lead levels if the test has come back positive?
So it depends on the level, really. Most of the levels that I've seen have been at a point where you call public health, they'll come and look at the environment, and the answer is you remove the source, and then you do repeated tests to see if the body is slowly moving it out. It's a fairly significant intervention if you are trying to actually hasten the removal from the body. There are things we can do. I've honestly rarely seen those being done, but there are ways to kind of remove lead from the body through a variety of substances that we can administer, either orally or, if we have to, IV. But again, that's thankfully become much more, rarer in our society.
So in recent decades, the number of children with lead poisoning has come down with much more aggressive environmental restrictions on paint and, of course, to getting lead out of the water. But what needs to happen to eliminate lead poisoning in children?
Well, it means we have to really hunt down these last sources. You know, the paint thing is tricky because people often don't know if they have lead paint in their home. And that's why we ask the questions about the age of the home and, you know, is there chipping, flaking paint, and why we do the testing for those who live in older homes. A lot of the other comes from looking at soil hazards. You know, is there contaminated soil? So maybe your home is fine, but your child is playing outside and there's actually lead from a former or nearby industrial site. And then, of course, the plumbing, which is really the big issue right now, that replacing those lead water pipes is really key because we know that it'll leach into the water that children are exposed to so much.
So explain how it does leach into the water. How does lead get into our drinking water?
Yeah, so there's a variety of ways by which that process can happen. As you mentioned earlier, lead is a very soft, you know, easily manipulable material. So it's very popular in terms of using it on plumbing, either as a solder or welding material or as part of the pipe material itself. Now, often, if many listeners may remember what what was discovered in Flint, Michigan, it wasn't that there was necessarily lead leaching into the water continuously over decades. It was that a change in the Flint water supply caused some of the buildup that was kind of shielding the lead from coming from the pipe material into the water that started to eat away. And now there was lead leaching into the water. And that was a pretty egregious situation because residents said, hang on, my water doesn't look the same. It doesn't taste the same. And they were told, there, it's fine. And the answer was, no, it wasn't fine. So it's sort of a leaching process that it gets in there. And again, it's odorless, it's colorless in small amounts. And that's what makes this so tricky.
So if it's odorless and colorless, how do you find out if there is lead coming out of your tap?
The only real way would be to test it. So if you're concerned or you're suspicious, then having it tested would be the best way to do that. And of course, having your child tested because it may not be the water. It may be another source.
And so what does lead, if you've been drinking lead contaminated water, and I know you're a pediatrician, but what does lead do to pregnant women?
Lead can also transfer across the placenta and affect the baby. We don't focus so much on what happens to adults themselves, pregnant or not, mostly because adult brains are mostly developed. We don't see effects at relatively low levels of lead, although again, it's not something I'd recommend, whereas we see the biggest changes in kids. But we know that it can certainly transfer across the placenta and affect the developing fetus.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with pediatrician Dipesh Navsaria. He's explaining toxic lead exposure in children and the health consequences. You can join in with your questions about lead. And Milwaukeeans, we want to hear from you. Does your home have lead service lines? Will you be getting them replaced? And what about the bill? How do you go about updating your home to ensure that there isn't lead exposure? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Navsaria, how do you reduce the levels of lead in your drinking water? Is it solely to replace the lines? Or are there other filters, or what can you do?
There are filters and other routes to going about that, and for that, I'd refer you to a water quality expert to really talk about the different efficacy of those different methods. I always feel my job is to point out the effects on the body and to screen for it. I will say that one of the interesting things about lead is that a lot of these relatively hard to detect but very real changes are things that we worry about in kids all the time. It's been associated with hyperactivity and other behavioral problems. And again, these IQ drops are very real. So when we think about, why are there these students that seem to struggle so much in school and have these issues, and why is there so much ADHD and this and that? We should be asking ourselves, is this a consequence of things like lead exposure that's causing aggression, that's causing attention problems and an inability to learn? And of course, we as a society bear the costs of all those things in very significant ways. So when people say, oh, it's too expensive to replace lead pipes, I would also argue, actually, it's too expensive not to replace lead pipes.
So you know that there's an impact on the brain. There are things this neurotoxin is doing to the brain. What about the other systems in the body? I'm thinking like the liver, the kidney.
It can affect other parts of the body. Both the liver and the kidney are routes by which the body removes things from the body that shouldn't be there or don't need to be there. We know that there can be some effects there. We haven't really seen long-term problems. It seems to be the brain, the nervous system that's the most sensitive to what happens in terms of lead exposure. I will say, as a historical point, the Romans used to use lead and lead glaze in their plates. And one of the theories out there, we can't go back and test so easily, is that was there some long-term chronic lead exposure back in ancient Rome? And that, by the way, the Latin term for lead is plumbum, which is where our word plumbing comes from.
Ah.
That's how prevalent it was.
Thank you for that bit of history. We appreciate it. So when you look at this problem and you have a parent who comes in and their child has tested positive and there have been multiple tests and that lead is in that child's bloodstream, that parent can feel really helpless and really guilty. What do you tell them?
Yeah, that's and it's really it's such a challenging situation. And I think parents, they don't do this knowingly, but they too can feel the sense of guilt. I allowed this to happen to my child. So the first thing is to say, look, we found out about it. You brought your child in. You're doing what you can in terms of identifying this. First thing is to move them to a safe water source. That's what we saw in Flint. My friend and colleague, Dr. Hannah Atisha, the pediatrician who identified this in Flint, was moving her patients all to non-city water immediately in response. And then again, get public health involved. Let them come and investigate what's going on in the house. Where's the source of lead? And then let the abatement process move on from there. Obviously, if the levels are extremely high, then I would refer to my colleagues in toxicology and see how they could help us. But otherwise, we'll follow the levels, and the body will remove it. And then we can say, great, over the next, if it goes down adequately over the next 2-3 months, then okay, wonderful.
What kind of therapies do you refer out then when these tests come back positive? You know there's going to be an impact on the brain. Where do you refer?
Usually for relatively mild cases, we We talk about things that families can and should do at home, reading together on a regular basis, playing together, all the things that actually are great for kids' brain development in general. If we are seeing significant exposure, then of course I can refer to local birth to three services, which is what we would do for any kind of possible or known developmental delay, and let people do assessments and follow them over time, as well as provide the needed therapies that are needed. That's the thing. We can't undo what LED itself did, but we can certainly move things up in terms of positive development.
Dr. Navsaria, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Dr. Dipesh Navsaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Here with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about two friends who served in the Vietnam War together.
James Blankenheim and Everett Wood are friends with a shared experience of military service during the Vietnam War. They speak of the excitement of forging one's path in life, the realities of combat, and the struggles of integration after returning home. Blankenheim and Wood shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative. As a warning, parts of the story describe battleground violence.
My name is Jim Blankenheim, 71 years old, and I'm in Madison, Wisconsin. And my partner here is a corpsman that was with me in Vietnam.
My name's Everett T. Wood, and my age is 73. And I'm in Vincennes, Indiana. The relationship to Jim is he was a forward observer with us and called in artillery airstrikes and tried to help us out during the bad times when we needed help. So how did you get involved? Did you get drafted?
No, I enlisted. My father, when I turned 18, made the comment that he thought I'd never amount to shit. And I said, I'll show you. And not only would I join the military, but I would join the toughest branch they had. That's how I got the Marine Corps. And also, I felt I needed to do my duty anyway. It's run through our family. So how about you, Doc?
Well, I got off high school. I didn't know what I wanted to do in life. My parents didn't have very much money. You know, I didn't want them to help me through school. You know, I just wanted to be on my own and try to find my own direction, I guess. So I joined the Navy. So remember Hill 1192?
Oh, yeah. That was probably the bloodiest battle we saw.
That was the worst I've ever gone through.
There was like 80 of us walked up into the mountains on what they said was going to be a three-day patrol. What was it, 15 days later we got out of there? Huh?
15 guys died up on that hill.
That we had no place to put the bodies or the wounded, so they all laid right in the middle of our mini perimeter. And Milligan was there. He got shot in the chest and shot in the leg.
Right. I patched him up.
He lasted 4 days before we could medevac him out. And when he went out, I thought he was dead. I thought he'd never make it. We went to that reunion in Ohio, and he showed up there, and I went, you got to be kidding me. You're alive?
I know.
Because I didn't think he made it.
I didn't even know.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, once they left, we put them on a helicopter.
Yeah, it's the last you heard.
I mean, you don't know if they're alive or dead. They never hear from them. So it's tough.
Did you ride home?
I rode home when I could, you know.
I could not tell my mother what was going on over there because it would have killed her.
Yeah, I know.
I just said, you know, like, you know what it was for us for a typical day? That's all I called it. You remember when we came home? The welcome home we got?
I don't know. I mean, I had problems adjusting when I came back.
Yeah, so did I.
I kissed the ground when I got home, when I got in.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I come home, and I walk in the door, and my dad was totally unaware that I was even coming home. And I walked in, and he gave me this big hug. In my entire life, he never hugged me like that. And I said, you know, for every rotten thing you ever did to me, you paid for it that day.
I mean, I was really happy to be back after seeing all the stuff we went through. I'm glad we made it through that experience together.
Yeah.
And after all these years, meeting each other again.
That was James Blankenheim of Madison, Wisconsin, and Everett Wood of Vincennes, Indiana. They shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Now, reimagining Lowhead dams and converting them into whitewater parks and fish passageways. This conversation, it comes to us from a listener suggestion. Dwayne emailed to say he wanted to learn more about Iowa's efforts to remove dangerous dams. Our team did some digging, and sure enough, over the past decade, Iowa has become a national leader in its water trails and Lowhead Dam public hazard program. What questions do you have about turning dams into whitewater parks? How would you feel about removing a dam in your community? 800-642-1234 to join in. And Dwayne, thanks for the tip. Nate Hogevane is Director of River Programs for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Nate, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you.
Good morning. The DNR says these Lowhead dams are really dangerous. Give us a picture in our mind's eye what these dams look like.
They're basically a wall across a river that backs the river up, usually just a little bit. It might only be a couple feet high. Sometimes they're up to, you know, 10 or 12 feet high. And the water, you know, isn't controlled or anything like you, like when you think of a big flowage type dam in northern Wisconsin. It's more of a, you know, just constantly falling over this wall.
A deep, and, yeah, drop.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah. And what happens is the water drops straight down in a very uniform way, and then it launches back up and creates something called a hydraulic or a boil line. And from there, water is going downstream, but it's also flowing back upstream toward the dam because it's a high spot on the water. And so what happens is people sometimes get stuck in these. And in Iowa, at least, we see 1 to 2 fatalities per year on average. Sometimes we don't see any, sometimes we see more than that, but on average, that's about it. About what we see. And so back in 2008, our legislature, after there was a rash of drownings at these dams, created the Lowhead Dam Public Hazard Program to address these dangers. And they mandated us to start spending some funds and working with communities around the state to address that hazard, and at the same time incorporate fish passage into any project that we were involved in.
And then lo and behold, whitewater parks come out of this brainstorm, if you will.
Right. certain communities have opted to do whitewater parks. And I should say that, you know, that's not our primary goal exactly, other than that, you know, when we go into a community and talk to them about what they might do with their dam, it's on the list of things that they're welcome to look at. And we've taken an approach saying that, you know, we can do anything from a removal to more of a utilitarian type of rapids, if there's a infrastructure reason that the dam is there. Or, you know, these kind of more economic development driven projects, whitewater courses, are on the table. It's just that they require a lot more local funding and a lot more local interest and effort because they're more expensive than other approaches.
How much more expensive are we talking about? What is the cost of one of these?
So the most recent one that was completed in Ames was about an $880,000 project. I just got all of their grant information back. And that would be one of the lower cost ones.
Mm-hmm.
We have four of these facilities in Iowa at this point. They're the most expensive one was about $2.5 million. That was in Manchester, Iowa, on the Maquoketa River. And there's one being planned currently in Des Moines right now at the Scott Avenue Dam, which is, it's on a very large river, you know, and it's in the middle of the city. And the dam is integrated into a bridge, and it's a very expensive project. That one will be, at this point I can say tens of millions of dollars. When the final design comes out, we'll know exactly how much that is. That one's partly being federally funded as well.
How common are these low head dams used for rivers in Midwestern states like your own, like Iowa?
Oh, they're extremely common. And a lot of these were originally mill sites, and they weren't necessarily like a concrete dam across a river. They might have been a pile of rocks that, you know, backed up some water that was used to drive a water wheel at one point. But, a lot of them were converted to like small hydropower dams that later, you know, became economically inefficient as other ways of generating power developed. Some of them are created in the Great Depression, actually, mm-hmm. As basically projects to keep people working.
Public works, mm-hmm.
Public works projects, yeah. And so a few of them are created more for water supply. In a lot of those cases, we would advise the community to, you know, replace the low head dam with a rapids type of structure. You know, because they still have some purpose. They're around for a lot of reasons, and a lot of them have outlived their original purpose at least. We see a lot of deterioration because a lot of these are pushing 100 years old or more. So a lot of times the communities we're working with are at a decision point, you know, it's like, we're either going to have a failure or we need to do something. And, nobody, at least in Iowa, is really paying or helping people financially to refurbish a dam as a low head dam. So that helps us, get a foot in the door with these communities.
Yeah, look at next steps or, you know, where you go from here. We're talking with Iowa DNR River Programs Director Nate Hogevane, who is explaining his state's efforts over the years to remove or modify these low head dams and perhaps to make way for more recreational uses and to mitigate the hazards that dams present. Have you visited one of Iowa's whitewater parks? What do you remember about the experience? How concerned are you about the safety of dams? Does the dam in your community have adequate fencing or signage? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Nate Hogevane here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about turning dangerous dams into river recreation and the Iowa model. The first Iowa whitewater park was built in Charles City in 2010. Closer to the Wisconsin border, Elkader boasts a single wave that is 22 feet wide. It's called the Gobbler. And here in Wisconsin, near Madison, the city of Stoughton is working on plans for a whitewater park along the Yahara River. Would you go this route to remove a dam from your community? How do you feel about the viability of these Whitewater Park projects? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. We have River Programs Director at the Iowa DNR, Nate Hogevane, who's with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take a call on this, Nate. Tom is joining us from Burlington with a question. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Here in Burlington, we have a dam that has dammed up Echo Park, and the park is it's only about 6 inches of water in there, so they have to do something about it, but they're afraid to do something because every time they try to drain it, there's so much cow manure, it smells, and the neighbors don't want them to drain it. But my question is this. Out west, we have these aquifers that are sucking up all the water. They're dropping it at an incredible weight, like some rate, like 40 feet a year or something, brother. And I just wonder, is there any way we can tie this in the rivers that we have on top of the land to get the water down into replacing these aquifers?
All right, Tom, thank you. So, Tom, concerned about aquifers drying up, can there be any solution with these rivers and, you know, perhaps the dams?
So western water issues and eastern water issues, and I'd say, you know, Iowa's kind of the last eastern state. I'd draw that line at about the Missouri River. Those issues are really different, the biggest difference is rainfall. So like in Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota, we're getting from, 20 to almost 30 inches a year. And out west, you might have like 12 or 15. I think in the Midwest, I had mentioned water supply earlier as a purpose of some of the dams, and sure, yeah, they can help create a shallow aquifer in some cases. And, like I said, we are able to, really accomplish the same purpose by building, say, a rock art rapids with boulders and smaller stone. But that's really just for collecting water, out in kind of a sand lens near the river. Mm-hmm. In terms of our deep aquifers, which I think he was referring to, those are recharged over a very long period of time, but we don't have those disappearing aquifers in the Midwest like they do out west.
Tom, thanks for the call. John is joining us now from Menominee. Hi, John. Go ahead. I understand you've paddled some of these whitewater parks before.
Good morning. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm a kind of a novice whitewater paddler. I enjoy getting out there and recreating with friends and people I'd like to hang out with. And, Wausau has got our premier whitewater park in Wisconsin, and some might argue in the Midwest, and I've paddled that many times. And, we'll travel around northern Wisconsin to find whitewater, the Red River, the Peshtigo, the Wolf, and go up to the Brule. And we have some whitewater over here in west central Wisconsin at Jim Falls on the Chippewa River, which is part of the dam release from the Chippewa. And I just, I think that these parks provide a great opportunity for people who have interest in paddling. It brings people will travel to come and paddle in those parks. And they, it brings up opportunities for local training and local groups and clubs to kind of congregate around these features. And I just think it would be a really great thing for any community to take that dam and transition it into a whitewater park if it's at all feasible to do that with your elevations.
John, thank you so much. So John really getting out there on these paddling trips and really bringing in that tourism piece and that community interaction, Nate.
Yeah, John, and thanks for bringing up some great rivers that bring up some great memories. I cut my teeth on whitewater in Wisconsin rivers, I actually first learned to do it from the Hoofers at UW-Madison. So, it really, what you're saying has bared out for communities in Iowa. And I can give you an example at Manchester, Iowa. There's a whitewater course with six separate drops that was created in 2012. And we actually did a study of how many people we would see on random days throughout the summer season, just in the area around the dam. We did that for 3 years leading up to the project being completed, and then did it for three more years after the project was completed. And this is just people recreating either on the water, fishing, walking along the river. We saw a 462 times increase in the amount of time people were spending along the river.
Wow.
And you also started to see other things like, a lot of downtowns in Iowa, at least, have kind of turned their backs on the river. Their main street might be like a block off a river, and just all the backs of the buildings that are facing the river. In Manchester, what's happened is people started building back decks on restaurants and bars, and a brewery opened up. It's just much more lively now. It's a kind of park setting with some retail mixed in.
So you saw that economic investment return there. Let's bring in Mark now in Green Bay. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hey, I didn't get the beginning of the show, but I was wondering when you replace these dams with these rapids, does it allow fish to move through the river system that weren't allowed to before?
Yeah, that's correct. We require in these projects that there's like a lower slope area next to the whitewater drop. So the whitewater drop is steeper and creates a wave, and it's actually not that great for fish passage. It's better than the dam, but not that great. So we'll have a lower slope area with kind of more rocks protruding out and stuff where fish can burst up. And we've done a number of studies on that too to verify that the fish passage is actually happening at these facilities. We also make it so that the fish passage part is favored when the water gets really low, like when you get into a drought condition kind of thing. Mm. So we're pretty careful to make sure that is incorporated. We're very serious about that because it has a huge effect on the river upstream, both for fish, but also, mussels, like little clams. Their young actually hitch a ride on fish's gills in order to recolonize stretches of river. And they're really important for water quality as well. And I think we're all for that.
Yeah. Mark, thank you so much for that question. Nate, as we start to wrap up here in the last few seconds, do you have any tips for communities that might want to go this direction and convert that low head dam into a whitewater park?
Sure. And I think the biggest one is, you need to start by, putting out some ideas, and doing some education. But the critical thing is that everybody gets listened to right up front, mm-hmm. And that it becomes a whole community project, as opposed to, maybe you've got one city council person and a business person with this big idea, and they're going to put it on the whole town. Yeah. I've seen that over and over again where that just doesn't work. You need to have those town hall meetings and have everybody who is interested in your river and that dam in particular needs a seat at the table and they need to be heard. When you start that way, it's just better.
Nate, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate. I very much appreciate it.
Nate Hogevane is Director of River Programs for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.